R.
From WBUR Boston, this is special coverage of the aftermath of terror. I'm Tom Ashbrook. The signs are everywhere. Saturday Night Live pokes fun at Jesse Jackson's telephone diplomacy with the Taliban. "Hey, Mr. Taliban," Jesse says. Movie fans line up for Michael Douglas's new action thriller, Don't Say a Word. And Michael Jordan is back. Slowly but surely, America is giving itself permission to look away from the horror. But where's the new center of gravity in the entertainment world in a world that we're told is forever changed? We begin the conversation with Robert Siegel, editor-in-chief of the satirical weekly print and online publication, The Onion. Hello, Rob.
Hello, Tom.
I'd like to start with one of your headlines. Hijackers surprised to find selves in hell. It doesn't seem as if you've changed your style since September 11th, have you? We begin the conversation with Robert Siegel, editor-in-chief of the satirical weekly print and online publication, The Onion. Hello, Rob.
Hello, Tom.
I'd like to start with one of your headlines. Hijackers surprised to find selves in hell. It doesn't seem as if you've changed your style since September 11th, have you?
We had to be a little more sensitive than we usually do, but we didn't want to just shy away from this whole issue altogether and pretend it didn't happen. I don't think that does anybody any good. But yeah, with that one, we tried to think of who could we actually take a shot at and apply our usual mean humor and get away with it.
So what did the hijackers find when they ascended to wherever or descended?
Most of it is pretty unprintable. Well, printable but not repeatable on air. But just various horrific tortures of unspeakable varieties.
72 virgins.
So yeah, well, no, they expected. They thought they were going to. They thought they were going to heaven, but in fact, they wound up. They wound up going to hell. The heavens await. The virgins awaited them in heaven.
Yes.
But instead, they were. Hellish.
Not exactly paradise.
No, it was not.
In The Onion, you peel away at social propriety to reveal hidden truths, I guess.
Yeah, sure.
What truth are you trying to get at with headlines like "Not Knowing What Else to Do"? Woman bakes American flag cake.
Just the sadness of the whole thing. It's kind of a strange form of humor. It's not really laugh out loud humor. A lot of people just didn't really know what to do in the days and weeks following the attack. So that's just that's meant to capture the sort of helplessness that people felt in a funny way.
I'm looking at your website. You've got U.S. vows to defeat enemy, whoever it is we're at war with.
Right.
Can it be unpatriotic to be ironic, or is it all part of being American?
I think it is part of being American. I think there's definitely an air of patriotism and earnestness, and obviously everybody's wearing red, white, and blue right now, and we don't mean to. I mean, everybody here is feeling that too, but I don't want there to be any kind of suppression of free speech as a result of this, and we feel like there are actually things that can be safely laughed at in the midst of all this tragedy, and our reader response has been really unbelievable. People are actually really happy to have something to laugh about in this time when not that many other people are really joking.
I thought you were great in the note you caught in the Bake a Cake column. I mean, everyone has felt it. You've got her. She's already donated blood, mailed a check to the Red Cross, sent a letter of thanks to the New York Fire Department, and then she finds herself, and how many of us did, aimlessly wandering from room to room.
Yeah.
And then she bakes the cake. It's funny, but in that gentle way that we were all lost on those days.
Yeah, a lot of people, we had readers, many readers write in and say that actually made them cry, which...
Yeah.
Is not our aim, but any reaction, any catharsis that we can bring about, whether it's laughter or tears, we're happy to get.
Mm. You also get down to some real kind of angry humor, even moralizing humor. Headline: God angrily clarifies "don't kill" rule, and you have the Lord pounding the podium and saying, "Didn't I tell you? You know, what part of this didn't you understand?"
Yeah, again and again. I've told you this a million times. It's incredibly clear in the Bible, but still some people don't seem to get it. Yeah, that was definitely one of the more popular ones on the site.
Well, and at the end, you have him, upon completing his outburst, God fell silent, standing quietly at the podium for several moments. Then, witnesses reported, God's shoulders began to shake, and he wept.
Yeah.
this is not exactly a pie in the face humor.
No, no, and it's not even really. It's the Onion voice, but it's not. It's a little different from our usual voice. It's a little. There's a little more. It's just, but definitely more emotional than the typical Onion. I mean, really, people were. Seem to be genuinely moved by a lot of it, and that's not usually our primary goal, to move people, you know. Mm.
So here we are, almost 3 weeks after the terrible day. What's the tone of your editorial meetings now? Where's your humor going? Maybe we can take it as one sign of where American humor is going.
Well, we don't want to beat this thing to death, but we certainly don't want to ignore it, and we want to make it okay to laugh. And I think a lot of people were sort of waiting for permission to laugh, and I hope this frees up other comedy outlets, whether it's TV shows or other websites or magazines, to actually start making some jokes again and some relevant jokes. I think there are ways to laugh about this without actually laughing at it.
And what's your long range forecast, Rob? Are Americans going to be laughing in the same way in the year ahead, or has something changed here?
My forecast for laughter?
Yes, sir.
I predict 100% jocularity with partly. No, it's I think people are going to laugh. I think people want to laugh. I think people want to laugh right now, and they feel guilty about it. May I quote George Bernard Shaw?
Please do.
All right. This was actually sent in from one of our readers, and I thought it just perfectly. Summarizes our attitude on the whole thing. Mr. Shaw, a wise man, of course, said, life does not cease to be funny when people die any more than it ceases to be serious when people laugh. And I think that really summarizes it. I mean, the fact that to laugh right now, I don't think is any way disrespectful to the dead. It's just a recognition that, you know, we're human. And I think it's an important part of the healing process. And I hope people don't fear laughter, even if it does touch upon, especially if it touches upon the things that are going on right now. I think we need to laugh.
Thanks, Robert.
Thank you.
Robert Siegel is the editor-in-chief of The Onion. He joins us from his office in New York.
Having our city's institutions up and running sends a message that New York City is open for business. Saturday Night Live is one of our great New York City institutions, and that's why it's important for you to do your show tonight.
Can we be funny?
Why start now? Live from New York! It's Saturday Night!
Saturday Night Live kicked off the new season with help from New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani. What is the role of the entertainment industry in this time of national crisis? Taking its virtual presidency role very, very seriously, the hit show The West Wing has delayed its scheduled season opener and replaced it with a special terrorism plot. David Letterman has replaced, however briefly, his biting wit with heartfelt soul, and halftime shows at football games are now extravaganzas of patriotism. Is it time to permanently shelve the blow-em-up die-hard breed of movie? Can culture still be as trivial as the cast of Friends, or is a dose of silliness, like the new movie Zoolander, the right prescription for a country still in pain? Join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255, or join us online at WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. Joining us in the studio tonight is Charlie Pierce, writer for Esquire magazine and a regular contributor to the NPR show Only a Game. Hey, Charlie.
Hi, Tom.
Good to have you.
Good to be here.
Also with us are Bob Thompson, professor of media and popular culture at Syracuse University. Hello, Bob Thompson.
Hello.
Hi, good to have you.
Thanks.
And our news analyst, as always, Jack Beatty. Hi, Jack.
Hi.
We're talking about American popular culture. It's coming back. The lights can't stay down forever. What are we going to see as it all comes back on the screens, great and small, around the country? What are the early signs, Bob Thompson? Is it the same old, or is there something new that's emerging as we turn back to the world of entertainment?
Well, you know, that first week or two, it seemed impossible that we could ever do Saturday Night Live again, or Spin City, or Letterman, or all the rest of it. But I think amidst all the hyperbole of how this has changed everything, we underestimated the resiliency of American popular culture. By Saturday, the first Saturday after Tuesday, I will never forget this. Tom Brokaw does this very moving hour-long kind of retrospective of what had happened for the first couple of days. Mm-hmm. And at 9 o'clock, right after he's done, without a commercial, without a single bit of station identification, no transition whatsoever. The opening of Growing Up Brady, this made-for-TV movie about life behind the scenes of the Brady Bunch, pops on. And I think it suddenly occurred to me how extraordinarily able American popular culture is to absorb and digest even the most colossally horrible sorts of events. Letterman now, of course, is pretty much back to business as usual. And Friends and Spin City debuted last week without a by your leave, not even one of these little apologies that have become so typical as these programs go back up on the air again. It's not as though there won't be any changes. It's not as though this hasn't put mutations into the culture that we will live with forevermore. But I think maybe we overestimated how the entertainment industry would be impacted by this.
But does that mean that we're resilient and we're ready to both grieve and be entertained at the same time? Or does it mean that we're pulling the electronic covers up over our heads and pretending it all didn't happen?
I think it's a combination of both. I mean, if we go back in history during the entire kind of cultural unraveling that the 60s was all about, the Vietnam War and civil rights and the Democratic conventions and all the rest of it, in 1968, the year of the Tet Offensive, the My Lai massacre, the assassination of Martin Luther King and Robert F. Kennedy, one of the most popular shows on the air was Gomer Pyle USMC, which took place in the contemporary Marine Corps. And, of course, all he ever worried about was not going to Vietnam, but would my locker be clean enough for the big inspection by Sergeant Carter? Even World War II, if you go back and listen to radio, the comedies were back on by December 8th, 1941. And until we get into later in 42, for the most part, they ignored the war entirely. Television has got this unbelievable ability to deliver out of the same box in the same living room both the horrific images of September 11th and the anesthetic that's able to kind of take us away from those images, the sorbet that clears our palates of what we saw for the past 2 weeks.
Charlie Pierce here in our studio in Boston. How do we process this, this sort of sublime and ridiculous and horrible, suddenly all mixing together? It's rushing back in. How do Americans put that together? Or is it even a problem? Is it hard?
Well, I would agree with what Dr. Thompson said, particularly in his, I think, praise for American popular culture for being a remarkably durable beast.
Mm-hmm.
It has, I mean, if you go back, Abraham Lincoln was made merciless fun of in the middle of a civil war. Baseball shut down in the 1940s, but not for long. I think that given the fact that we channel so much of our energies and so many of our passions into things like popular music and sports and popular literature and the popular culture of the television and the movie theater, I think that makes us a healthier place. It's better than sitting around speculating on various forms of martyrdom.
There's a limit to how long you can do that, and yet we don't want to forget what happened.
No, I don't want it to be an anesthetic. I think this should hurt for a long time. I think we should demand of television, you know, not merely that it deliver to us our sitcoms, but that it, you know, get its overpriced conglomerated rear end back into foreign affairs where it belongs. I just recall when the whole thing blew up in the Balkans, how totally new that was to me. I didn't know about any of that stuff. And one of the reasons I didn't know about any of that stuff is nobody was wandering around Europe for the networks anymore. One of the enduring memories of my childhood, as far as foreign affairs, was a guy named Irving R. Levine, who covered the Vatican. The Pope didn't move without Irving R. Levine knowing it. There are none of them. I mean, we just can't depend on Christiane Amanpour forever.
So we want the news, but it's entertainment that's coming back, too. Jack Beatty, what's your confidence that the television executives will find the right balance?
I'm sure they will, because life is the right balance. Joyce, we quoted George Bernard Shaw earlier. Well, James Joyce called life an intensely serious low comedy. And that catches a lot of it. I mean, tragedy goes on, but so does the comedy of everyday life.
Yep.
And I think the sheer eclecticism of the medium lends itself to representing life in all its contradictions.
Listeners, what are you looking for now from entertainment? Are you ready to laugh? Are you ready to cry? Do you want a good old-fashioned blow-em-up? Are you done with all that? Join the conversation. Call us at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Or join the conversation online at WBUR.org. Click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage of the aftermath of terror from WBUR Boston. From WBUR Boston, this is special coverage of the aftermath of terror. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Lee Greenwood's God Bless the USA is back on the charts. Wow, can you believe it? We're talking about the return of the entertainment culture. What is the state of popular culture in a country moving through grief? In a time of stark reality, is it time to put the brakes on reality TV and get back on the Partridge Family sitcom bus? Is political humor now unpatriotic? Is this the end of irony? We're talking with Charlie Pierce, writer for Esquire magazine and a regular contributor to NPR's Only a Game, Bob Thompson, professor of media and popular culture at Syracuse University, and our news analyst, Jack Beatty, also here. Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Bob Thompson from at Syracuse. What about, give us some examples of the entertainment that's coming out since the comeback, since the taboo's begun to lift. What's caught your eye and ear?
Well, first of all, as we would have expected, the comedies are back as strong as ever. Friends, I think, had the best rating it ever had in its past outing. And part of that had to do with the fact that it was a big cliffhanger that was being resolved. Part of it has to do with the fact that I think people, after 2 weeks of this coverage, were desperate to get back to their own familiar territories of viewings. All the desires and appetites that made those shows popular in the first place had been put on hold, but they certainly didn't go away. The weird thing was the coincidence that these networks had in place five shows about undercover agents, three of them dealing directly with the CIA. You know, 3 weeks ago, I thought the networks were, you know, what was this, 1985 again? Mm-hmm. Suddenly we were worried about these kinds of issues. Now, of course, these shows have essentially become war series. And my guess will be that if it's true what we are hearing, that this is going to be a long, drawn-out military engagement with very little traditional narrative closure, where we get to see victories and the rest of it, people are going to turn to their fiction for those kinds of victories. I think it's why shows like Armageddon and all the rest of these explosive dramas were very big in the video rentals days after this happened. I think also some of these spy shows like Alias, 24, The Agency will do very well, only because people are going to want to see these victories of good over evil in fiction, because they're probably not going to be getting a lot of it over on CNN.
So much for the hand-wringing or the notion that we were all done with blow-em-up shows. You say they were big sellers in the video stores.
I think we were over with those for the first 2 weeks after this happened, and I think probably that should have been the case. It wasn't appropriate to put that stuff on. People were still going after it, though, in video stores, and I don't think that means that they're sick or they're perverse. I think it's, you know, art has this way of trying to work this stuff out, and I think that's exactly what was being reflected. My guess is that Schwarzenegger film will come back, and that Law and Order episode about terrorism that has been indefinitely shelved will probably come back as well and be more relevant than it was before this happened.
Jack Beatty, what do you see unfolding here as the lights come back up on Broadway? Is the entertainment industry going to help us in some way process this in a productive way, or is it escapism that we're looking for?
Well, in a way, I think escapism, as I think other people have been saying, is what's called for, at least in part. What we're escaping from is a nightmare, and better escape from it than to wallow sort of promiscuously in its repetition. I mean, I think that the television networks really pushed the limit the week after the disaster by showing, as a kind of visual punctuation, again and again, the planes slamming into the towers. There was a wantonness and a callousness about that. And just to escape, to expunge those images from your brain, yes, you need to laugh, you need to cry, you need to sing with a musical, but partly just to get rid of those images that TV itself has implanted there. I happened to not have a TV the day this happened, and I heard it on radio, and it wasn't until the next day that I looked at the front page of the New York Times that I saw the image, and then it had the effect. It had but somehow just hearing it had at least braced me for the horror. And then when I saw the picture, I was somewhat ready. I can only imagine what it must have been like for the naked, unprepared viewer sipping his coffee to look up and see this thing happen, and then to see the networks repeat it and repeat it.
But we're moving beyond that now, Jack, and we've got listeners who want to talk about that move on from those horrible images. Listeners, we're at 1-800-423-8255. What are you ready for now in popular entertainment? Do you want it to help you process what's happened here, or do you want to get the heck away from what's going on? George is on the line. Welcome, George. You're on the air.
Hi. Hi. Thanks. It's nice to be talking, and great. I love the show.
Thanks very much. Great to have you.
Okay. I just wanted to call. What struck me, I heard you talking earlier to the editor of The Onion.
Yeah.
And I brought up The Onion on my website today for the first time since the event, and I was overwhelmed by the piece about two pieces, the piece about the terrorists going to hell, which was somehow amusing, but the one about God being angry at people killing people,
yeah.
Which was at once very funny, but at the same time, by the end of it, I was moved because in a way that I hadn't been by any of the patriotic tributes or anything. It was just true, and in an attempt to humor and art and that kind of thing can get to truth and, a kind of catharsis.
Yeah, God pounding the podium in real grief there.
Yeah.
I think that you're right, George. Charlie Pierce, you've seen The Onion. It does have a punch.
Yeah, it does, and I think it struck exactly the right tone for that particular issue of The Onion, but it also does open another question to me, and I'd like Dr. Thompson's and Jack's opinion on this. If this is going to be a long, prolonged Twilight struggle, at what point does American popular culture regain its sort of subversive edge?
Right, which I think Bill Maher asked us that question as well. He's been taken off in a number of cities, and there was even some question as to whether that show would be canceled in its entirety.
Bob Thompson, recount that incident for us.
Well, Bill Maher came back on Politically Incorrect, and as opposed to the usual kind of, and David Letterman, of course, in that rhetorical bit of pulling an unbelievable rabbit out of his hat, coming back the Monday night after this had happened, he set the stage, almost a new genre for the episode of comedy show that is the first one after a terrible tragedy,
mm-hmm.
And everybody pretty much followed in the same footsteps, mostly with less impact. Bill Maher, of course, being the person he is and doing the program he does, came out swinging, and he actually had some really good points. Which
you said they weren't cowardly, and perhaps we were cowardly for sending cruise missiles up
and
to
that
do our
was
work.
That was the problem. I think his overall point was, of course, that, and he said this directly in that same episode, which is just because this has happened doesn't mean the other voices need to be silenced, that we need to quit making fun of the administration, and that some kind of diversity of voices now have to suddenly to cease. However, he packaged it in a terrible tactical rhetorical error, which is the whole idea of questioning the cowardliness of the terrorists and, in fact, suggesting the cowardliness of us for sending missiles over there. And in doing that so close to when this happened, however one agrees or disagrees or whatever with him, he in essentially completely landmined his entire argument because it was just such an ineffective time to do that.
And Ari Fleischer came down on him like a ton of bricks.
Oh, he sure did. Now, that's changing. I think we're starting to hear those other dissenting voices, and comedy has always been the place where I think that's most effectively been done. And if we continued after 3 weeks and 4 weeks and 5 weeks to still see comedy backing off from this kind of thing, then I think we'd really need to be concerned. I don't think we're going to see that, though. I think we're already seeing comedy beginning to reassert itself in these areas, and I think another couple of weeks we may be surprised at how much it reasserts itself.
Yeah, and And comedy can take the place of politics for a while. We're not going to have politics. We're going to have unity. And that's not good in democracies. And comedy and the sort of cynicism and irony, these things can sort of substitute for politics for a while.
Thanks, Jack Biddy. Listeners, are you ready for a little bite at the comics microphone? What is it you're looking for from entertainment? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Mike is on the line. Welcome, Mike.
Hey, good evening. Thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you.
Hey, thank you very much. Yeah, I'm a writer, and I'm an historian, and, you know, like everybody else, I was glued to the TV and NPR, and there's a couple comments I want to make. One is I was truly staggered by how the news media came across as one of us. I mean, the average American instead of sort of a detached entity. I mean,
was that a change for you, Mike?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm not old enough to remember, but I got the impression that you'd have to go back to about World War II to get the feeling that we're all in this together. I mean, Korea, Vietnam, and beyond, you definitely had the feeling the news media was sort of farther outside looking in. So I just want to make that comment. I mean, that's as a writer, that's sort of interesting to see.
And on the entertainment front, Mike?
Well, on the entertainment front, I got a comment I'd like to share with you guys, and that is that my wife is a big Friends fan. I never really cared for the show too much, but I thought, you know, what the hell? We need a break from all this god-awful, you know, terror watching day in, day out. And the very last show before the premiere, you know, about leading up to the wedding, all the characters on the show, I got so absorbed with what was happening that all of a sudden they interrupted it to show George Bush and Tony Blair. And this was shortly before, you know, Bush is going to address Congress.
Yes.
And I had completely forgotten. I had completely forgotten that there was this whole problem outside of our house. And so I'm all for entertainment, you know, being there to, you know, support us and give us something to be distracted by and to enjoy.
So, but you felt that it could drag you back down into that state of happy not knowing.
Yeah, you know, I got to admit, I mean, I grew up pretty comfortable. You know, nice neighborhood upstate New York, the whole thing. And for my whole life, I've been pretty detached.
We got it. We got it, Mike. Jack Biddy, you hear that. I mean, let's face it, that huge American media machine can take you way off this planet if you're not careful. But we've learned that we share this planet with some folks who are not too happy with us.
Yeah, we did. And you know, the popular culture of the 90s was sort of registering some of this in these disaster movies. We were seeing one after another of some alien force coming down and often indeed in one Independence Day blowing up the White House. And in another, Deep Impact, we actually saw water knocking down, as I remember, the Twin Towers. And it's as if the unconscious of popular culture was saying to people in the 90s, you think you've escaped from history. You think that these oceans are going to keep you immune to the bloodshed in the Balkans and the genocide in Africa. But you're all part. This is what globalization means. You're in it. We're all in it. We're in it, as someone said the other night, for the duration.
Mm. We're talking about patriotism here, too. Charlie Pierce, you've got long and keen antenna all over the culture, but sports is your homeland. And sports have often been a kind of bastion of red, white, and blue patriotism. Do you see that returning now? Are we really locking down the flag overall in sports land?
I'd be careful, by the way. You can't use the word homeland without Tom Ridge's permission anymore.
Okay. We'll try to keep it secure.
Yeah, I think, and we had a taste of it, I believe, during the Gulf War, particularly in the aftermath of the Gulf War, where every sporting event was this kind of triumphal pageant. The one thing you have to remember about sports is it is a regularly scheduled mass gathering, usually for celebrations of something. The only one we have, really. I mean, the political conventions are regularly scheduled mass gatherings, but they don't celebrate very much anymore. If there's any pop culture moments that are conducive to kind of elephantine red, white, and blue spectacle, it's the sporting events, and you will see that. During the Gulf War, there were a number of different incidents. There was a basketball player named Marco Lokar for Seton Hall who refused to wear a flag in his uniform and was Lithuanian, literally run out of the country because of that. And the other thing about sports that I'd just like to mention is that of all the American popular cultures, with the possible exception of the music, sports has got reach. The only time I've ever been to the Middle East, I went to Qatar for the World Cup Asian Zone qualifying in 1994, I believe it was, or 92. And there was one sporting goods store that we could find. And they had all the jerseys of all the competing teams The only thing they were sold out of was Michael Jordan jersey.
Figures.
And this, and believe me, Qatar is not the end of the world, but you can see it from there. It's, you got to really want to go there.
And now he's back. Is he some kind of diplomat or face for us that works in this new crisis that gets us global support, or is that
they're all chiming in again. He's donating his salary to various relief efforts, which will be $1 million a year, and the Nike Corporation will take up whatever else he needs to keep body and soul together. He's playing in Washington for all that means now. He is a remarkably well-known face around the world. And you got the other thing you have to remember is that the corporate culture in this country is the one pushing us to get going, to spend, to go back to the mall, to go to Disney World, as the president says. The major professional sports are largely playthings of that corporate culture now,
right,
even to the extent of people who go and watch the games. The president of the United States owned a baseball team. So whatever that culture seems, whatever the imperatives of that culture is, you're going to see it reflected quite vividly in sports, I think.
But, Charlie Pierce, our stadiums have also become points of vulnerability.
Exactly right.
And does that cast a kind of spooky pall around things?
I think that sports events, because of their regularly scheduled and because they are large gatherings, usually outdoors, are the canary in the coal mine on security devices. You have to remember that the facial scans that the people are proposing to use generally now were first used at the Super Bowl in Tampa. So I would point out that what you see as you go into Lambeau Field or Foxborough Stadium here in New England is what you may well see generally. If you want to keep an eye on what the security people have in mind for the rest of us, that's a good place to start looking.
Bob Thompson, Jack Beatty was talking earlier about the role that entertainment has played and asking if what the flavor it's going to be, and pointing out that in the 90s we had a lot of destruction films, maybe presaging what's going on here. When you look ahead and just look out as far as you can, do you imagine the entertainment media somehow shifting? Are we going to have the kind of noir feeling that we had during the Cold War, or are we too pepped up and high charging in our media for that these days?
Well, I think comedy is going to benefit. Comedy is going to do very well in this period, as it always has in practically any period. I also think, however, that there is this sense that we used to have to manufacture fear and danger through reality TV, whatever, during peacetime. And for that matter, the narrative convenience of terrorisms and comets and tidal waves during a time when, after the Cold War, we felt that there was no longer that kind of threat. Now, of course, I think we've got that kind of threat. We don't have to manufacture it. And I imagine there will be a Cold War return to this very both palpable enemy, namely terrorists, but at the same time very mercurial one. On the patriotism side, though, what I find has been really fascinating here is that we have associated returning back to our amusing, silly entertainment with a patriotic duty. Rudy Giuliani asks Letterman to come back on the air. The president is asking us to get back to normal. I mean, after Pearl Harbor, there was a sense that everybody ran to enlist into the armed services. After this thing, there's a sense that we feel it's our duty to go see a Broadway play.
Bob Thompson, hold that thought right there. Listeners, are you looking to get back to something frivolous and familiar, or do you want to put your eyes straight on this brave and scary new world? Call us. We're at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. You can join the conversation online. Log on to WBUR.org. Click on Special Coverage Forums. We're looking at entertainment and what entertainment's going to be in the wake of the blasts. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage of the Aftermath of Terror from WBUR Boston. This is Special Coverage of the Aftermath of Terror from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the return of entertainment as America pulls up its socks after the tragedy of September 11th and gets on with life. We're joined by Professor Bob Thompson, Professor of Media and Popular Culture at Syracuse University. Also with us is Charlie Pierce, a regular contributor to Only a Game and Esquire magazine, and our news analyst, Jack Beatty. Listeners, what are you looking for now from movies, magazines, television? Do you want a new perspective or an escape? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. Anna is joining us on the line. Anna, you've been very patient. Good to have you with us. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you today?
We're great, thanks.
Well, I was actually on tour with the Proper Ladies. We do songs and parlor ballads of the 19th century.
Oh, now we're not dying hard here. This is something else entirely.
Right. Well, we were out on the West Coast. We left on September 10th from Logan.
Mm-hmm. That's in Boston's airport.
Boston's airport. Mm-hmm. And our first performance was scheduled for September 13th. Needless to say, we saw the news, and we then started calling people and found out that everyone was still going to go ahead with their performances.
So you went ahead, and what was the response you got to your parlor music?
That's what I'm getting to. The first one was on the 13th, and that was the one that we got the response to last. And it turned out that the reason was that one of the woman who actually was putting it together, had lost a very close friend on Flight 93.
Mm-hmm.
But she said when she called us, "I hope you're coming. We're ready." And after the performance, and we had...
Were people showing up out of duty, or were they able to really sit back and enjoy what you delivered?
Well, she said we had maybe 10 to 20% of what they expected that
mm-hmm.
night.
Mm-hmm.
I think they did enjoy it. We did rewrite all of our performances. We did include a commemoration. And it was interesting because we do it from the perspective of 1901. I haven't heard this. I don't listen to the radio or watch television a whole lot, but I have not seen anyone refer to the fact that on September 6, 1901, President McKinley was shot and he died on the 13th, on the 14th, and Theodore Roosevelt became president.
Mm. Anna, so, thanks for your call. Everybody's watching the calendar these days and finding these spooky, crazy connections between months and years across time. We've got a lot of callers who want to join us. Bill is on the line. Bill, welcome. You're on the air. Hello, Bill.
Hello.
Hi.
I went to the ballet the other night, and I had expected to feel feelings of guilt and didn't, and was also amazed that it seemed like other people felt the same way.
What performance did you see, Bill?
It was A Midsummer's Night's Dream, so it was the most frivolous play, ballet available.
And did it speak to you, or did it seem irrelevant on that night?
Well, I had expected to feel conflicted, and yet at the beginning, uncharacteristically, they played the national anthem. The entire audience broke into song, and it was very poignant and very stirring. And then it seemed as though that the players were spurred on to form beyond the norm and were really excellent. And it was one of the best nights I had ever had at the ballet, and I was really surprised to
Yeah. Bill, you're expanding our view. I want to put that to Bob Thompson. Bob Thompson, we're talking about popular culture a lot here and a return to what we've known. But don't the arts and entertainment have a kind of duty also to really explore this new terrain we've come into? Can't they be instrumental in helping us figure out the new world that we're in now?
Well, I think they can. But, of course, popular culture is what responds most immediately to this stuff. We're going to see the West Wing trying to process this in what was the closest thing to an impromptu episode, the closest thing to live TV we're going to be getting in primetime television. The classics, of course, one can begin to find these kinds of ways in which they deal with timeless kinds of issues and so forth. But I think in its ability to sort of instantly interpret and analyze things, pop culture is really the avant-garde in a strange kind of way for this.
Mm. And Jack Beatty, the hallmark of all culture, and especially pop culture in the 90s, was irony. Is that still with us, or is that gone with the wind?
Well, one way to think about that is to think of the opposite of irony, and that is the mind of Mohammed Atta. A man terribly, mortally in earnest, no shade in his mind, no deflection in his mind, each thought like a nail being driven into a piece of wood. That's life without irony. And when you see that, you say, bring on the irony. I mean, irony is a sort of prop of the modern consciousness. It's not going to go away. It came in with World War I. It came in with the poets as they tried to apply their understanding to this ununderstandable event, and they couldn't do it. And their genres, pastoral and lyric poem and so on, broke against the reality of industrial warfare, and irony was the result. It began, Robert Graves said, with the abridgment of hope, that's the sentiment that generates irony. And, of course, that could be a sort of epitaph for the 20th century, the abridgment of hope, which was an experience just everyone felt. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we're beginning now, a little bit like those war poets, with something we have to process, and inevitably we're going to process it ironically. That is to say, dealing with something completely unforeseen and trying to make sense of it with the categories we have. And it's that incongruity between what might be expected and what actually occurred that generates irony as a sentiment and as a literary style.
What do you say, Charlie Pierce? Is it still our mother's milk?
Oh, I think so. One of the things I've done a lot over the last couple of weeks is listen very extensively to Harry Smith's great anthology of American folk music, where the history of the century pops up ironically in many different places. There are humorous songs celebrating Charles Guiteau, the assassin of James Garfield, probably the most meaningless political assassination in the history of the world. But he's got a song. There are songs making fun of and capturing the spirit of lynchings in the South and grinding poverty, and all of it done ironically. And, I mean, Grail Marcus has a great phrase he uses called the old weird America, and I think that's the one that keeps bubbling up underneath all the patriotic hoo-ha, is that part of America that is irreverent. I mean, my Lord. I mean, a guy like Ari Fleischer just begs to be mocked. And sooner or later, the United States of America, the old weird America, will bubble up and take a piece out of him, I'm sure.
And maybe that's the vaccination we all need at some level. Listeners, we're at 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about the state of American entertainment in the aftermath of tragedy and grief. Julia's on the line. Welcome, Julie.
Hi. I was prompted to call. Actually, I'm on my way home driving today, and I'm listening to this show, and I'm thinking that perhaps if maybe this weekend my friend, who I found out today had ended her life this weekend, had been diverting herself from other than the tragedies that are taking place in New York and elsewhere, perhaps if she had been, you know, out at a theater or a play event, she might still be alive now. And I, that to me is the irony that, you know, this is pervasive, and it's going to stay that way unless we have that sort of hope. Mm. I think we need to get outside of our heads a little bit and try and see and focus on some of the brighter spots.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Julie, thank you for your call. It's a terrible story, and terrible in any time. But yet I think we can all relate to your speculation that somehow all this darkness of the last 3 weeks can get into people's minds and drag them down. Bob Thompson, the U.S. media machine is expert at taking us out of that kind of sump, isn't it?
Oh, it certainly is. And this is what I think is the story with legs. Irony, it's not going away. Comedy, it'll be back. All this stuff is going to come back to normal. It's interesting in that story and a number of others we've heard that the opinion of American TV and Hollywood, which was a scapegoat universally, its promiscuity, its suggesting sexual lack of morals, the fact that it breeds violence. All of a sudden, in one fell swoop, the attacks on American popular culture have been very much internal and bipartisan in this country, mm-hmm. have now been affiliated with the attack that these terrorists launched.
Yeah.
And the day that we saw those Hollywood studios worried that they were going to be the site of the next attack, we realized that a very new, strange bedfellow had been made. And I think the culture wars are going to change dramatically. All of a sudden, to be attacking American popular culture in the way that we've done in such a facile, sort of universal way.
We've thrown our flag around that culture, too, haven't we?
All of a sudden, now that makes us, in a weird way, an ally to what the very argument is that's being made by the terrorist. And mm-hmm. that, I think, is going to be the biggest change we will notice in the oncoming years.
Mm. Charlie Pierce, last thoughts?
I hope that we enjoy ourselves and use the popular culture as an expression of who we are and not as a distraction, because I would hate to wake up at halftime of the Super Bowl this year and discover that, like, the Bill of Rights is gone. But I do hope that we take this as an expression of who we are, and I hope we can more fully express ourselves as the months go on.
Jack Beatty, you confident that will happen?
Well, I don't know. I don't know. But I just want to remind you, someone mentioned the Cold War and analogizing it to this today. I mean, the great work of art of the Cold War was Dr. Strangelove, which transcended and made sense of the absurdity of
how I fell in love, learned to love the bomb.
There you go. Mm. And we, you know, Oscar Wilde said, we need art lest we die of life. And I think art is something both to move us and also to instruct us and to make sense of this terrible event. And as someone said, process it psychically and culturally. Mm. And that's going to take a long time and many different forms.
But there has been enough death. Thank you, Bob Thompson and Charlie Pierce. Bob Thompson is professor of media and popular culture at Syracuse University. Charlie Pierce is a regular contributor to NPR's Only a Game and writes for Esquire magazine. Jack Beatty is our special coverage news analyst and a senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. You can continue this conversation on pop culture and the aftermath of tragedy with other listeners online. Click on WBUR.org and further to Special Coverage Forums. Each night, we're hearing the voices of people around the country in a segment we call Audio Diaries. Tonight, we hear from Peter Ellsworth, a journalist from Providence, Rhode Island. Last weekend, Peter visited New York and found that the terrorist attacks have changed more than the skyline.
I went to New York City the weekend after the attacks for a bar mitzvah, and I didn't know why, but I was totally unprepared for the sight of the new skyline of the island where I'd lived for over 20 years. It's one thing to see the images on TV and in the papers and magazines, but it was quite a jolt to see it with the naked eye. And so while walking down 2nd Avenue a bit later, I was struck by a T-shirt in a shop window with whatever printed across the front. I stopped and stared. Whatever? Well, 6,000 plus lives ever. The mantra of an age of irony suddenly seemed trite and irrelevant. A week before, I thought to myself, that might have worked in that world-weary way in which everything was considered a target for irreverence. Throughout the prosperous 1990s, we laughed with Jerry Seinfeld and his gang, giggled with patronizing interest at America's kitsch culture, believed that the Internet was ushering in a new world order, and became ever more obsessed with the material excellence of our lives. Occasionally, reality broke into our daydream, but we often managed to make a soap opera even of that. Witness the maudlin outpouring that followed the death of Diana, the people's princess. And such major events as the Gulf War, and the first bombing of the World Trade Center and the federal building in Oklahoma City came and went, but never dented an era of glib frivolity. Perhaps in an age of peace and prosperity, it is easy to be cynical. Nothing is earnest or real. This detached coolness was most apparent in the Gen X generation, maybe because their parents' political idealism had been tempered by the cynicism that followed Watergate. Wide-eyed commitment seemed naive and vulnerable. Better to hide behind a Mad Magazine facade of what me worry. Now that has changed. Some things do matter, and watching thousands of people die is one of them. There are many images from September 11 that we will live with for the rest of our lives. For myself, the sight of those towers crumbling like that was the most shocking and horrible thing I've ever seen. But I also found most disturbing an account of people fleeing down the emergency stairs in the World Trade Center as firefighters were coming out laden down with equipment. A man who got out said that the firefighters provided a sense of calm that might otherwise have been missing. But those firefighters, hundreds of them, were trudging to their deaths. Whatever does not begin to work with such images.
Peter Ellsworth is a producer for WRNI in Providence, Rhode Island. Over the next few weeks, you'll be hearing more audio diaries from around the country. We'd like to hear from you. Send your submissions for next week's audio diaries by email. The address is special@wbur.org. To listen or read other radio diaries, log on to our website at wbur.org and click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You've been listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston.